Greetings and affrications, my excellent listeners, and welcome to this May 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this newly minted science podcast, Jim Campanella. I pointed out last month my lack of sleep and overwhelming exhaustion. Well, the semester is not over yet, so let's just leave it at that. In short, not much has changed. Let's get going before I fall asleep at the mic, something I'm sure none of us wants. The first story of the night may make the male part of the audience a bit uncomfortable because it has to do with, well, female plumbing, so to speak. So if you have kids listening or are just uncomfortable about the topic, you may want to skip ahead about 5 or 6 minutes to get beyond this particular story. So what is this anti-macho, squirm-inducing story? Well, Dr. Jacques Revell of the University of Maryland and his colleagues have just published this month a new study of vaginal microflora in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Why is that so important and what do they expect to find? Well, it's important to know what bacteria are normally found in vaginal passages to know what's healthy and what's not. This is related in purpose to the studies done on the digestive system to see what bacteria are present that indicate a healthy or abnormal digestive tract. Dr. Revell states his purpose very precisely by saying, quote, "Without a complete understanding of interactions between our human genome and microbial genomes that are present in our bodies, it is going to be impossible to obtain a complete picture of human biology and translate this into better treatment and diagnosis." Unquote. Revell is targeting a new question that has just arisen in animal biology in the last few years. And the question is this. Because the number of bacteria are greater than the number of animal cells in a particular organism's body, like a human, how do those bacteria affect gene regulation and development in a whole animal? We're just starting to answer questions like that. One of the most well-known related questions that's come up in the popular press over the last couple of years is, do the various bacteria in our gut control our weight or not? So what did Revell find? Well, put simply, his group found that every woman has a unique vaginal microbiome. Those unique biomes, according to Revell, could change how doctors diagnose and treat gynecological diseases. In other words, not all vaginas are created equal, at least in terms of the bacteria that live there. During a 16-week study, the researchers evaluated microbial samples taken from the vaginas of 32 women. The researchers discovered that not only is each woman's vaginal microbial community unique, but also these microbiomes can change radically in just a short time. Previously, Revell's research had shown 5 distinct types of microbial communities exist in the vagina. Additionally, that earlier work found that those biome types seem to vary with a woman's ethnicity or race. In the new paper, Revell asked 32 women to take swabs of their vagina twice a week for 16 weeks. Each week, the women sent the samples along with a diary of their sexual and hygiene habits to the researchers. I am assuming that Revell controlled for the inevitable outside contamination that would take place. That was not really discussed in the paper. Remember, you're asking laymen, or laywomen in this case, to take their own fluid samples and send them through the mails, and not contaminate those samples from any outside source that may throw off results. I would be a bit more sanguine about the paper's results if all the samples had been taken in a clinical setting. At any rate, to identify changes in the microbiomes, Revell and his collaborators sequenced bacterial ribosomal RNA genes from the samples. As in his previous work, he characterized each woman's bacterial colonies into one of the 5 known types based on the kinds and quantities of each bacteria present. The paper states that the most surprising finding was the dramatic day-to-day changes in some of the vaginal microbiomes. Again, this could be artifactual based on the sampling method, but for the moment we'll just accept his findings. Revell said, quote, "We saw a certain kind of community in one woman. 3 days later it was 99% different, a major shift in composition. On the other hand, some women's vaginal composition did not change very much at all," unquote. This is the first study, by the way, to look at human vaginal ecosystems over an extended period of time. Despite the actual bacterial differences from woman to woman, the chemical surrounding of the healthy vaginal tract seemed rather unchanged. The same metabolites were produced by different bacterial populations. For example, lactic acid, like that produced in yogurt by lactobacillus, was consistently detected. Revelle does not know the purpose that these vaginal microbes serve, why they vary, or why they produce the same byproducts. However, if his results are correct, they may serve a general function that bacteria in the gut serve, that is, as a kind of place marker. There are good bacteria, if you want to call them that, that fill up the space to keep out pathogenic bacteria. In other words, the bad bacteria cannot get a foothold in the niche because those ecological spaces are already filled with some other organism. So the bacteria may serve a protective function by simply being there and doing no harm. Revelle says that his research is a, quote, gateway, unquote, to personalized medicine for women. By determining the different vaginal ecosystems that exist and how they vary from woman to woman, gynecologists may be able to understand what each patient's normal and healthy vaginal colonies may look like. Then if the patient gets an infection, the doctor could more precisely prescribe a probiotic unique to that woman's microbial makeup, instead of just a general antibiotic that would kill both the good and the bad bacteria in her system. Next, Revelle plans to continue his studies by upping his samples to 135 women who will examine their vaginal biomes each day over 2 months. Those results should clue scientists into the behavior that causes vaginal bacterial colonies to change and what the microbial community is like just prior to an infection. Okay, I'm done with that story if the squeamish among you want to tune back in. The next story is sort of in the same vein as the first, although it has nothing to do with reproductive bits. Just as the biomes in the first story vary from woman to woman, it turns out that cancer cells from the same tumor may be very different in their genetic makeup. Dr. Stephanie Jeffrey, Chief of Surgical Oncology at Stanford University, published an article in the May issue of the journal PLOS ONE that found that not all tumor cells express the same genes, and that includes cells within a single patient, and even a single blood draw. Additionally, the important finding for cancer treatment is that cancer cells circulating in the bloodstream differ significantly from tumor cell lines used in drug development. That result implies that cancer drugs developed using those laboratory cell lines in vitro may not be effective against the actual circulating cancer cells found in vivo. In vitro, remember, refers to any work done in a test tube or petri dish and not in a living organism. In vivo is actually in the body of a living organism. Jeffrey said, quote, "The different cells that are disseminating may go to different organs or may represent different populations. And therefore, if you treat cells with just one drug or drugs that hit one population, you may not get rid of all of the disseminating cancer," unquote. Jeffrey was working with breast tumor cells, but presumably her findings are not limited to those metastatically progressed cell types. The researchers isolated the circulating cells from the bloodstream by using magnetic particles to get out live tumor cells. They then measured the mRNA expression for 87 different cancer-associated and reference genes in each single tumor cell and compared expression of each individual cell. Jeffrey's new method can make it possible to assay changes as a tumor progresses and tailor treatments very specifically to many different cell types. Exactly which genes should be targeted and how those cells might respond to different drug therapies is still a bit of a mystery and needs more clinical information. Even though that clinical info is needed to see if there's any worth to Jeffrey's approach, the technique has not yet been approved for use in clinical trials. Dr. Jeffrey and her research group are still trying to perfect the process and get an understanding of how the different populations of identified cells respond to various drugs. Speaking of cancer, the next story is another cancer story. I don't think that this upcoming story will come as a great surprise to anybody, although I had a conversation about this some time back with my office neighbor down the hall, whose research work is the development of cancer. He told me that the two biggest threats to getting cancer were smoking and obesity. I was a bit surprised by the obesity, but apparently that risk factor has been known for years. If obesity is a risk for cancer, apparently weight loss will ameliorate that risk. In the May 1st issue of the journal Cancer Research, Dr. Anne McTiernan at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle found that shedding weight can knock down levels of inflammatory cells and proteins in the body. How is that related to cancer? Well, since chronic inflammation is a risk factor for many cancers, the new findings suggest weight loss might reduce cancer risk. Oddly enough, that inflammation reduction results seem to be limited to actual dieters, not to people who lost weight through exercise. People who embarked on an exercise-only program failed to lower their inflammatory load substantially, despite losing a few pounds in weight. You would think that any weight loss would get the desired result, but apparently caloric reduction has some special effects on physiology which are not seen simply by exercise increases. The three-way link between inflammation, obesity, and cancer risk has been previously established, as I pointed out earlier. For example, obesity has been linked to increased blood levels of a protein called C-reactive protein. When C-reactive protein increases, there are associated increased risks of breast, colon, and lung cancers. Dr. McTiernan randomly assigned 399 overweight and obese postmenopausal women, yes, just women, into one of four groups: dieting plus exercise, dieting only, exercise only, and as a control group, one required not to do either. People assigned to the dieting groups lost a mean of 8 to 11% of their body weight during the study. Those assigned to the exercise-only plan lost an average of 2.4%. Blood tests before and after the 12-month trial show that women assigned to dieting who lost at least 5% of their body weight with or without exercise had substantially greater decreases in levels of inflammatory proteins and cells than the control group. That group showed no change in the inflammatory markers. That result, by the way, clearly suggests that the percent weight loss is the most important indicator of whether there'll be a decrease in inflammatory markers. It seems not to have had anything to do with whether there was just exercising or just diet alone, as the paper suggests in its conclusions. In fact, I'm not entirely sure where McTiernan and company came up with their conclusions given their results. Anyway, the last two stories of the night have a serious cool factor. That was not meant as a pun, but the next story probably has about as cool factor as you can get. Have you ever drunk a milkshake too fast, or done the same with a cold drink, or even ice cream? What inevitably happens is the phenomenon that we all know as brain freeze. If you have never experienced this, then you're welcome to go get an ice cold drink and slug it down quickly, making sure that your upper palate and the back of your throat get thoroughly drenched with the cold liquid while drinking. In many cases, you will quickly induce a headache in your temples. For years now, it's been a mystery how this headache is induced. That is, until now. The results of this research were presented last month at the Experimental Biology 2012 conference in San Diego. Since I know several people who went there, I had access to conference proceedings which described the talk that was presented. The main researcher of the presented work was Dr. Jorge Serrador of Harvard Medical School. For years, medical doctors would tell you that brain freeze was caused by stimulation of the trigeminal nerve by cold food or liquid. Well, now that seems to be pretty much wrong. Serrador's findings are the result of trying to get a better understanding of how migraines work. It was not his goal, as is often the case in science, to discover what causes brain freeze. Serrador had hypothesized that he could more easily study migraines by inducing them with cold liquids. Migraines are notoriously hard to predict and notoriously hard to study. Researchers aren't able to monitor a whole one from start to finish in the lab. They can give drugs to induce migraines, but those can also have side effects that interfere with the results. Brain freeze can quickly and easily be used to start a headache in the lab, and it also ends quickly, which makes monitoring the entire event very easy. Since people who get migraines a lot are more prone to brain freeze, Serrador thought that he'd take advantage of that. The researchers brought on brain freeze in the lab by having 13 healthy volunteers sip ice water through a straw right up against the roof of their mouths. The volunteer raised their hands when they felt the familiar brain freeze coming on, and raised them again once it disappeared. Serrador said that they monitored the blood flow through their brain using an ultrasound system on the skull. His group saw increased blood flow to the brain through the anterior cerebral artery, which is located in the middle of the brain behind the eyes. That increase in blood and resulting intensification in the size of this artery brought on the pain associated with the brain freeze. When the artery constricted, reining in the response of the increased blood flow, the pain disappeared. Serador said, quote, "The dilation, then the quick constriction of this blood vessel may be a type of self-defense for the brain. The brain is one of the relatively important organs in the body, and it needs to be working all the time. It's fairly sensitive to temperature, so the widening of the blood vessels might be moving warm blood inside tissues to make sure the brain stays warm." Unquote. The brain pain that Serador describes has to do with an increase in pressure because the blood influx into the brain can't be cleared as quickly as the outflow away from the brain during the cooling process. That slow process of movement out could raise the pressure inside the skull and induce pain. As the pressure and temperature in the brain rise, the blood vessel constricts, lowering blood flow and reducing pressure in the brain before it reaches dangerous levels. Serador hopes that this understanding of blood flow and pressure may lead to better headache treatments for migraines. The last story of the night has to do with a new way to control how cloned genes may be turned on and off. Whenever I talk about gene regulation in my genetics classes, I explain that there are two basic systems of regulation. First, genes that are constitutively regulated. That means that they're simply left on and expressed all the time because they're so important. These genes are sometimes called housekeeping genes because they're required to sort of keep house in a cell. And the second type are genes that are induced to be turned on. That means that some environmental factor, either within the cell or from outside the cell, may turn the gene expression on and off. Examples would be if you have a specific inducer chemical present, like a sugar, like lactose or glucose, then the gene would be turned on. Another example would be if you would turn on your gene when the levels of the product produced by that gene got too low. Other controls may be entirely environmental, like a metal ion, such as copper, may turn the gene on. There are even genes in animals and plants that respond to light and get turned on and off by that. Well, although it does not exist in nature as a natural regulatory system, Dr. Jeffrey Friedman and his collaborators at Rockefeller University have genetically engineered cells to secrete insulin in response to radio waves. Their results were published in the journal Science last month. That is so awesomely futuristic that it sends the SF fanboy in me into virtual paroxysms. Friedman and his team used antibodies to target iron oxide nanoparticles to a temperature-sensitive channel. Upon exposure to the appropriate radio frequency, the nanoparticles that were tethered to the channel heated up and spurred the channel to open and allow calcium ions to flow into the cell. Then the scientists put a modified version of the human insulin gene under the control of a calcium-responsive promoter into those cells. So the calcium influx generated by the warmed nanoparticles produced expression of the insulin gene and insulin release from the cell. Finally, they showed that their system worked in vivo by injecting cells under the skin of nude mice with all the requisite components in them. When the mice were exposed to the appropriate radio frequencies, they experienced a significant increase in plasma insulin and a significant decrease in blood glucose. This awesomely new system could be a huge clinical boon because it could allow the addition of a drug or enzyme into deep tissues, which is not that easy in humans and animals. Low and medium radio frequencies can penetrate deep tissues, allowing the promoter to be turned on by those. Friedman's technique has several advantages. First, it doesn't require a permanent implant. Second, just localized cells can be modified to express. And finally, those radio waves can reach into deep tissues. The method could one day be used to activate any calcium-dependent process or to treat deficiencies of proteins that are difficult to synthesize or deliver, especially those needed in the central nervous system. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Don't drink your iced coffee too fast this spring and summer, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.